Welcome back to Making Waves. As we continue to explore current issues, we now bring you Media Minutes to give us news about network neutrality and take a look at how journalists fail to provide proper context to the issue of immigration.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The Federal Communications Commission has approved the joint purchase of bankrupt cable company Adelphia by the country's two largest cable firms, Comcast and Time Warner. The $17.6 billion deal will give Comcast and Time Warner control over half the cable subscriber base of the United States, with virtual dominance of the top 20 cable markets. While the FCC placed some conditions on the acquisition, mostly with regard to providing independent cable channels and sports networks access to various cable systems around the country, Comcast and Time Warner are free to trade Adelphia's various service territories between each other in order to strengthen their regional monopolies. Commissioner Michael Copps dissented from the decision in large part for this very reason.
Nothing in this order can rebut the simple truth that less competition equals higher prices. Indeed, when you step back and look at the totality of these proposed transactions, the direction here is unmistakable. This decision is about big media getting bigger, with consumers left holding the bag. My advice to consumers when they hear about the wonders of clustering and consolidation is to hold on to your pocketbooks. This is not a consumer-friendly transaction.
Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein also dissented in part because the FCC is not requiring Comcast and Time Warner to adhere to the principle of network neutrality, a condition placed on the mergers of AT&T with SBC and Verizon with MCI less than a year ago.
It was a major step back to let these large media conglomerates, including two of the nation's largest broadband providers, go even bigger without requiring that they comply with these basic network neutrality principles. We should be thinking about how to enhance our consumer protections in the broadband world, not to erode them.
Andrew J. Schwartzman, president and CEO of the Media Access Project, helped lead a campaign which resulted in nearly 30,000 public comments filed with the FCC questioning the implications of the Adelphia deal. He says he's pleased that the transaction was not simply rubber stamped, but he's very concerned about the lack of action on the issue of net neutrality.
We will see a less open and less free internet. That combined with the loss of competition and the increased rates that will come from that, mean that in balance, this was an unfortunate transaction which the FCC approved.
A few months ago, the Media Access Project threatened a legal challenge to the FCC's decision if it did not fully address consumer concerns. Schwartzman says it's too early to tell whether such an action is still justified, but he's keeping his options open.
It's premature. This is going to be a lengthy decision, and the devil is always in the details.
In the short term, as for the customers of Comcast, Time Warner, and Adelphia, prepare for rising rates. Since 1996, cable rates have risen on average more than 60%.
Immigration may be shaping up to be an election year issue, but there's much more to the story than desires to beef up U.S. borders or deport millions of people. Deepa Fernandez, host of WBAI New York's morning program Wake Up Call, has been digging extensively into the business and politics of immigration for a book she's just published on the subject. She says media coverage of immigration is one-dimensional and lacks any historical context, like the fact that even harsher anti-immigrant legislation was debated in the House of Representatives last year, to which an amendment was offered that would have effectively declared open season on immigrants by bounty hunters. Fernandez covered that debate on Capitol Hill, along with other national correspondents, only one of which reported on it. Everybody else, she says, gave reasons for ignoring the story.
You know, I got told everything from my editor would edit it out. It's not the most important part of the bill. It's only an amendment. My audience is not interested in that.
Given this context, the immigration debate of today seems shallow and insubstantial. Fernandez says that's because much of the news taking place around the issue now happens nearly exclusively under the rubric of fighting terrorism.
But it's not actually doing anything to protect against terrorism, and you can even leave that aside. What it's doing is overwhelmingly building up a state apparatus where immigrants can be surveilled and monitored and arrested, jailed, and then deported.
Because immigrants who do not yet have citizenship status have limited rights under U.S. law, and they are some of the people most at risk by immigrant roundups conducted under the guise of anti-terrorism, Deepa Fernandez believes journalists have an obligation to help protect them from undue persecution. Her new book is entitled Targeted, National Security and the Business of Immigration, and is published by Seven Stories Press.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Now for Jav Parrish with his latest commentary about unions.
I have this vision that because I own a dog, soon I'll be legally prohibited from joining a union. This is Jav Parrish. It's not quite that bad, yet. But a series of decisions expected this summer from the Bush-appointed National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, could destroy the existing union memberships of millions of people in the United States and prevent any future unionization attempts by tens of millions more. Under 1947's notorious union-busting Taft-Hartley Act, supervisors in the United States workforce are considered management and therefore have no legal right to unionize. The anticipated NLRB rulings on three disputes collectively known as the Kentucky River cases would allow employers in a wide array of industries to reclassify their employees as supervisors. This would apply to any employee who has any type of oversight, no matter how fleeting, over a lower-ranked or less senior coworker. For example, workers who take on apprentices, lead men in manufacturing crews, nurses who direct nurses' aides. And, well, I order our dog around. A lot. She seems to like it. It really is just about that ridiculous. A nurse, for example, has no power to hire or fire, doesn't set schedules, can't hand out discipline. Yet under these rulings, she or he would be considered management. The anticipation of a favorable ruling already has employers around the country chomping at the bit. AFL-CIO Organizing Director Stuart Acuff estimates that the NLRB has already deferred about 120 cases in which union election results have been disputed. Employers want to wait for the Kentucky River rulings to see if they simply can declare their workers ineligible to join any union at all. Nurses with a common contract at 12 New Jersey hospitals have already threatened to strike before they reached contract language that guaranteed they wouldn't be reclassified as supervisors. In a mid-June NLRB hearing, the chief nursing officer at Virginia Mason Medical Center in Seattle offered a novel argument against a suit demanding that the hospital negotiate with the nurses' union before implementing a contested policy. She argued that all 600 of Virginia Mason's RNs were in fact supervisors. They were able to hire, fire, and write policy, and therefore weren't eligible to be in the union at all. Virginia Mason's nurses say that's ludicrous. They don't have any of those powers. And the AFL-CIO's Acuff warns that there could be health care and hospital strikes across America if the decision is too broad. A study released this week by the Economic Policy Institute shows that it's not just nurses that are in trouble. In a worst-case scenario, up to 8 million union members could be disenfranchised. Such a ruling, covering two-thirds of America's unionized labor force, would not only decimate organized labor, but undercut much of the Democratic Party's organizing and get-out-the-vote infrastructure. And maybe, ultimately, that's the point. Given the NLRB's record under Bush, labor leaders aren't optimistic the Kentucky River will turn out well. They're particularly alarmed that in Kentucky River, as in all other cases since Bush took office, the NLRB has refused to hear oral arguments, the practice in all previous administrations, Democrat and Republican alike. The NLRB is expected to rule on these three cases, ironically enough, before Labor Day. Labor leaders want the public to ask members of Congress, at minimum, to force the NLRB to actually hold hearings on Kentucky River. This past week, workers demonstrated in cities across the country. On Thursday, labor leaders committed civil disobedience in front of NLRB headquarters in Washington, D.C., in a desperate bid to get attention for the issue. This is a story that should be front page news. So far, it's not. From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jav Parrish.
Following Jav Parrish's commentary about unions, we bring you Red Eye Co-op Radio's interview with Larry Keene about the ongoing Oaxaca, Mexico teacher strike.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
A week after national elections, many laud the emergence of a multi-party democracy in Mexico. But the horrific attack by security forces on the town of San Salvador de Atenco in May showed that repression against campesinos and indigenous people continues. Political corruption and allegations of election fraud also persist. As I speak, thousands rally in Mexico City to protest the official election results. In the midst of continued struggle, one hopeful change in Mexican civil society is the emergence of an independent trade union movement. At the forefront of union activism are teachers in the southern state of Oaxaca. Striking teachers there are being credited with ending the domination of the PRI in Oaxaca, despite an attempt by the governor to crush their strike. Larry Keane is with the BC Teachers Federation. He helped organize the visit of Oaxacan teacher and union activist Antonio Garcia to the recent World Peace Forum here in Vancouver. And he joins me in the studio this morning to tell us a little bit more about the strike. Hi, Larry.
Good morning.
Now, I understand that this strike was about more than just wages and working conditions. What were teachers demanding?
They were demanding school meals for the children, particularly in the rural areas of Oaxaca. The families are lucky if they can get their children to school at all. And, so they're looking for, a variety of kind of social demands that related to education. Textbooks, the real basics of having kids able to learn because they're, fed and have access to materials.
Did they also have larger political goals in the sphere of like national politics or state politics?
Well, they've always been, for a very long time have been demanding more. The structure in Mexico is such that there is a negotiation of sorts at the national level, and on May 15th each year, the Mexican Teachers' Day, the government announces what they're giving to teachers after that. But teachers in Oaxaca have often gone on strike to get the state government to supplement what the national government was doing, and that's really what was happening in this case.
Now, in June, there was a massive effort by security forces to put down the strike. What happened?
Well, the teachers have been occupying the Zocalo, the center the large area in the center of the city, and they had been there for about 3 weeks by that time. And in the middle of and we had had messages from colleagues in Mexico saying that the police and army were being organized around the Zocalo, and they were expecting that there would be some kind of action to try to remove the teachers. There were about 4,000 teachers in the center of the city, sort of camping there. And the police and army moved in the middle of the night. They helicopters were dropping tear gas bombs. There were 1,500 police and army who came in and pushed the teachers out. And there were reports of several people dying, although the government denies that. Certainly Antonio, who was here, said that they knew of at least two people, a teacher and a child of a teacher, who had been killed in that. And I think about 60 people ended up in hospital that night. By the next day, the teachers came back, though, and were able to push the police back out of the Zocalo, and they're still camped there.
So are they getting support from the people in the town?
The day after the police attack, there was a march that is reported to have 400,000 people. There are only 70,000 teachers in Oaxaca, so it's 400,000 is a good indicator.
And it's a smallish town.
Yes. It's not Mexico City. As Antonio described it to us, that there were now a whole lot of social movement issues beyond teachers and education and even school kids, getting lunches or whatever, that this had become a major social movement.
That have kind of coalesced around the initial...
Yes, yeah. And the central demand was in addition to meeting some of the social demands, was for the governor to resign. Now, not much happened in regard to that because, of course, it was a run-up to the presidential election, and that's what's captured all the attention now, of course.
So the governor has not yet resigned.
The governor hasn't resigned, but there were stories circulating that the agreement was that he wouldn't resign until after the presidential election. But with the contested results there, I'm sure that he will have a little more space than he did before.
Now, I understand that community radio has also been a target of repression. What's the role of community media been in this movement?
The teachers' union was actually running a radio station, and they were broadcasting live 24 hours a day. And when the police attacked the teachers in the Zocalo, they at the same time broke into the union offices and smashed the equipment. But there is a university students' radio station that then picked that up and continued to do the broadcast. So community radio was really the key means to communicate. If you can imagine turning out 400,000 people in basically one day period, you know you've got to have some kind of communication system that gets the message out in order to get people to come and know what the story is on a demonstration like that.
And this is a radio station that was running just for the duration of the strike, or that had been running for an extended period?
I think the teachers had their own radio station for a while. It's really quite amazing. They've got a research center as well that. That's one of the gains the teachers made several years ago, was to set up an independent research center that teachers get about 20 teachers a year get out off their teaching duties to do research on education. And so they built up this kind of infrastructure that's part of the popular struggle generally there, but the teachers have really played a central role in that.
What is the role of popular movements in the trade union movement in Oaxaca?
Well, the Teachers Union in Mexico is the largest union in Latin America. It's got more than 2 million members. But it's also very bureaucratic. It was controlled by the party that controlled Mexico for 70 years. And in fact, you had to be a member of the PRI in order to teach until 1991.
You're kidding.
Yeah. So in the 80s, they developed this democratic current within the teachers' union. And so there are four states, where they are in the majority and have a majority on the executive. And they're mostly in the south. There's Chiapas and Oaxaca, as well as in Mexico City, and they really have been the central group in terms of the trade union struggle, and they made a strategic decision to stay in the union and fight within. There are others that opted out, and they're only very small and marginal, really, the FOT, the unions associated with the FOT, because the control has been so great in that kind of corporatist structure that existed in Mexico that's clearly falling apart now. But the teachers have played a very central role in that.
Now, what are some of the things that BC teachers have been doing to show solidarity with Mexican teachers?
Well, as soon as we heard about this happening, we did a letter and took it down to the consulate and met with the deputy consul to express our concern and ask the national government to pull the troops and police out of in terms of that repression. And the executive committee voted to send $10,000 to the union because they basically are having to feed teachers now because they've been on strike for more than a month. And when Antonio was here, we were able to give him a check for that amount. And one of our locals in Victoria sent $500 as well, as an expression of solidarity, reflecting the messages that we got when we were on strike last October, which were real morale boosters to teachers.
What happened then?
Well, when we were on strike, there was a group of teachers in Mexico City who went to the consulate and set up a protest there. They delivered a letter to the ILO, requesting the ILO to investigate. This happened in several Latin American countries as well, where we have long been doing solidarity kind of work, and it was
So there's a really strong connection going there.
Absolutely, yes, yeah. We've been working for about 25 years in various projects throughout Latin America, and in Mexico since NAFTA, we've had this coalition called the Trinational Coalition in Defense of Public Education, and some of us had been in Oaxaca just 2 months before the strike, because we had a conference there that brought together Canadian, U.S., and Mexican teachers who are concerned about the kinds of issues around trade agreements and their impact on public education.
Are you finding that you're fighting the same kinds of issues? They're fighting the same kinds of issues there as you are here?
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, that's one of the things that globalization has done, is to obviously at different levels of material support that we have, but the issues are very much the same, whether they're class size, curriculum issues, feeding kids who don't have meals. You know, those are common things to teachers, you know, really everywhere. And, you know, so it's a very sound basis for building solidarity.
Now, as I said before, you were part of a group that organized the visit by Antonio Garcia. What was his message to the World Peace Forum here in Vancouver?
Well, it was very interesting. I mean, he talked about all of the things that had been happening there, but he also said that the union was having some difficulty in adjusting to the new situation, because this is not just a teachers' movement in Oaxaca now. It's become a broad social movement, and so the teachers have a level of responsibility to, you know, to not just get something for themselves, and to, you know, but there really aren't structures to make decisions, you know, as we've seen.
It all sounds so familiar. Yeah,
that's
yes.
Right. That's certainly what struck me as I was listening to him, that it's, you know, even that is very much the same problem that we have always in trade unions and social movements trying to work together.
Well, thank you very much for coming down and telling us about it, Larry.
Great. If people are interested in looking at some video of the police attack, you can go to Working TV. If you just Google Working TV, you'll find there's some video on there, as well as a number of stories about what's happening in Oaxaca.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Larry Keane. He's an executive with the BC Teachers Federation. And as he said, if you want to see a video of the police violence in Oaxaca, you can see Antonio Garcia's presentation at the World Peace Forum, then you can go to Working TV. I believe it's workingtv.com.
You're listening to Making Waves. We now bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nasir Arouri, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, who examines the proportionality of Israel's invasion of Gaza after an Israeli soldier was taken prisoner. Journalist John Ross, who reports on Mexican presidential candidate López Obrador's demand for a recount of the contested July 2nd election, in which his conservative opponent Felipe Calderón declared victory. And Mimi Abramovitz, professor of social policy at Hunter College, who discusses the consequences that punitive welfare legislation will have on millions of poor women and their children. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year after British Prime Minister Tony Blair created the Commission on Africa in advance of the 2005 G8 summit in Gleneagles, the Commission has shut its doors. According to the Scotsman newspaper, after its funds were given to a United Nations panel led by Kofi Annan and anti-poverty crusader Bob Geldof, the Commission has not met in almost a year and has closed its press office. The Gleneagles summit, disrupted by the July 7, 2005 London terror attack, made a series of commitments to Africa: massive debt cancellation, new aid from wealthy nations, and trade reform, including the elimination of farm subsidies within industrial nations. Debt relief was given to 14 African nations, yet debt is still a huge burden for much of Africa. According to Africa Action, the continent's indebted nations still pay $14 billion a year in debt payments, only $1 billion less than before the G8 relief package. The G8 countries also promised to double aid to Africa to $50 billion a year by 2010. Yet, only France has lived up to its aid commitment, with England, the United States, and Italy falling behind on delivering new aid. Talks on a new agreement by the World Trade Organization have stalled, and hopes of cutting massive farm subsidies in the U.S. and Europe are slim. On Wednesday morning, July 5th, a small group of students gathered outside the National University of El Salvador to protest a recent 15% increase in electricity and a 25% rise in public transportation costs. As the crowd increased in numbers, the National Civilian Police, or the PNC, began firing tear gas. Reports stated some of the protesters possessed weapons, and there were other reports of military helicopters shooting down at the crowds. The police eventually raided and occupied the university. Two police officers and three students were killed in the confrontation. According to the Women's Global Green Action Network, Wednesday's violence follows the brutal assassinations on Sunday, July 1st, of Francisco and Juano Manjares de Manzanares, parents of Radio Venceremos co-founder Marina Manzanares, known as Mariposa. Salvadoran President Tony Saca and Minister of the Interior René Figueroa are blaming the violence on the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, or the FMLN, calling them terrorists. The Salvadoran National Assembly is currently trying to pass an anti-terrorist bill that would criminalize many nonviolent protest tactics. By claiming that such a bill could have prevented the July 5th violence, Saca and the right-wing Arena Party may be able to get the bill passed. After nearly a decade of delays, Cambodia is launching a war crimes tribunal to investigate the killing fields of the mid-1970s, in which 1.7 million people died from execution, forced labor, or starvation, nearly a quarter of the nation's population. Victims' groups are looking for an open process and truth-telling. As Yuk Chang of the Phnom Penh-based Documentation Center of Cambodia observed, the need for the victims to hear and tell their stories must be protected. The whole process is more important than the indictments. The Documentation Center has investigated the atrocities masterminded by Pol Pot's former Khmer Rouge government. It has investigated 20,000 mass graves, 189 prisons, and conducted 30,000 victim interviews. According to the Interpress Service, concern was raised about the process because of the unusual makeup of the panel, officially called the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia. The panel includes 13 international jurists and 17 Cambodian judges, but victims must wait until mid-2007 to get access to the War Crimes Tribunal. In other recent war crimes bodies in Rwanda and Yugoslavia, international jurists made up the entire tribunal in order to maintain a high standard of justice. This week's news summary was compiled by Denise Manzari and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
On June 25th, Palestinian militants tunneled into Israel and conducted a raid in which they took prisoner an Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit. Soon after, the Israeli army launched an assault on the Gaza Strip, Palestinian territory it had withdrawn from last year. Israeli forces took dozens of Palestinian government officials and activists prisoner, while planes and tanks destroyed bridges and the territory's electrical generating station, causing a medical crisis and shortages of food. More than 50 Palestinian militants and civilians have died in Gaza since Israel began its assault there. Hamas political leader Khaled Meshaal in Syria has offered to free the Israeli soldier in exchange for the release of Palestinian prisoners held by Israel, a deal flatly rejected by Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Israel has refused to negotiate with the Hamas government, elected by Palestinians in January, as they consider the Islamic Party to be a terrorist group. Israeli officials also rejected a call by Hamas Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh for a ceasefire, saying that Corporal Shalit must first be released and Qassam rocket attacks from Gaza into Israel must stop. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nasir Aruri, professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth, who examines the proportionality and repercussions from Israel's invasion of Gaza.
Well, I think the invasion that took place about 2 weeks ago, and actually in the past 3 days, 41 civilians have been killed in this invasion. And what amazes me is that very little is shown on the television and on the mainstream media particularly about the bombing and the civilians that have been perished 2 days ago. One of these was actually an entire family, including a six-year-old daughter, which I happened to see footage of on Al Jazeera. Hamas was elected in January, and just 3 weeks ago, Hamas and Fatah signed an agreement, a document that implicitly recognizes Israel because it is based on withdrawal and the two-state solution. It is very much a reaffirmation of the Arab League in 2002. However, this seems to have been a threat to Israel because Israel apparently is more comfortable with Hamas and Hamas's image being that of a terrorist organization throwing bombs, suicide bombing, even though Hamas has adhered to a ceasefire for over a year now, despite repeated provocations. But Israel is not comfortable with this kind of Hamas, just like it was not comfortable with the PLO in 1982. And therefore, they decided to embark on this invasion. Actually, I think I should mention here that last week there was a news story that appeared in Haaretz, the Israeli daily newspaper, saying that this invasion had been decided upon for many weeks. So the Palestinians, they dug this tunnel. They went in and they abducted an Israeli soldier, and that becomes a casus belli. Certainly, there was no proportionality to it, and I think that if the reason was, and it is not, the freeing of the soldier, the 19-year-old soldier, then the destruction of the infrastructure and the killing of civilians are not going to hasten the freeing up of the soldier and a negotiated settlement to this conflict.
Professor Nasser Ruri, tell us, if the Israeli objective here is to weaken the Hamas government, what effect do you think this Israeli invasion of Gaza will have in terms of the popular support for Hamas?
I think it might very well be counterproductive. In fact, there is already evidence that I have just simply from talking on the telephone to people who are on the scene in Gaza, not people sitting in hotels in Jerusalem and being resource people for the LER NewsHour and others. The sector of the Palestinian body politic, Palestinian society, that is not impressed with Hamas as a religious group, are more supportive of Hamas today than they were 3 weeks ago, for the simple reason that they see Hamas as taking really a moderate line. In fact, I think that it is a bit too moderate for certain sectors of the Palestinian community, but they see it as not overreacting and still proposing plans for diplomacy. We have not heard a single proposal from Israel for diplomacy. All they do is they say that we want to get our prisoner back.
And just a final question, Professor Ruri. How has the Bush administration reacted to this Israeli incursion into Gaza?
Well, the Bush administration actually can no longer say that it is the honest broker, nor can it even say that it is a broker. First of all, the so-called peace process has been put on ice since April of 2004, when Sharon made his last trip to Washington, held a press conference with Bush, decided to invoke what he called disengagement, and disengagement was a unilateral plan by Israel, and the U.S. acquiesced in it and in effect said there is no need for a peace process. So the peace process is not even on hold, it's really on ice. Secondly, and more importantly, the United States is in violation of international agreements, and it is in violation also of its own law. there is at least the Geneva Convention of 1949, which not only prohibits the occupying power from collective punishment, but it makes it incumbent on all signatories of the Geneva Convention, such as the United States, to see to it that other signatories, such as Israel, is not engaged in collective punishment, which is what it's doing when it cuts the electricity for 1.4 million people.
That was Nasir Arouri, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. He is the author of the book, Dishonest Broker, America's Role in Israel and Palestine. His forthcoming book is titled Palestine and the Palestinians. 1 week after Mexicans went to the polls to vote for president, hundreds of thousands of supporters of Andrés Manuel López Obrador of the Party of Democratic Revolution converged on Mexico City's Zócalo or Central Square to demand a recount in one of the most hotly contested elections in that nation's history. A preliminary count had López Obrador's opponent, Felipe Calderón, of the Conservative National Action Party, winning by some 400,000 votes. A second count of the July 2nd vote narrowed the margin between the two candidates to 243,000 of the 41 million cast. But López Obrador has criticized Mexico's Federal Electoral Institute for not counting almost 1 million ballots, which poll workers claimed could not be deciphered. The candidate, a longtime advocate for Mexico's poor, laid out numerous other election anomalies and screened videotapes to illustrate what he maintains is evidence of ballot tampering. The Federal Electoral Tribunal has until August 31st to rule on López Obrador's demand for a recount. The case can also be appealed to the Supreme Court. In his Mexico City rally, López Obrador announced plans for a national march to demand a vote-by-vote recount. The protest march will conclude in the capital on July 18th. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author John Ross in Mexico City, who reports on the aftermath of Mexico's contested presidential election.
On Saturday, Andrés Manuel called for marches to begin on Wednesday in all 300 of the electoral districts in Mexico, one end of the country to the other end of the country, to converge on Mexico City on Sunday, July 16th, for one more mega march through the city in attempt to pressure the Supreme Electoral Tribunal, the what's called the Trufe here, into opening up the ballot boxes and counting the votes one by one. This election was stolen in a lot of different ways, but one of the real ways that it can be shown who is the actual winner is to count the ballots one by one. And this has been done in a lot of other countries recently in close elections in Costa Rica and Italy and Germany counted the votes one by one. The ruling party is, of course, reluctant to allow that to happen because they know they're going to lose. And so we have this kind of face-off right now. This country is absolutely divided right down the center between the industrial north and the indigenous, impoverished but resource-rich South. López Obrador took 16 states, and most of them in the south of Mexico. Only one state went to the PAN, and some states in the Pacific north of the country as well. And the PAN took the states in the central and northern part of the country, 16 states as well. There are more people in the south than there are in the north, so PRD now represents, in this instance, 54% of the population. This is an election that has been, from the very beginning, about poor versus rich. López Obrador's slogan has always been the poor first. Felipe Calderón represents the fat cats, represents neoliberalism, represents the pain that neoliberalism has inflicted upon this country. And the choice is obvious. It's an election that has split the country right down the line geographically, politically, economically, and racially. This is definitely a face-off between the people who are the color of the earth, as Subcomandante Marcos names them, and people who are the color of money. And it's perhaps the most vital election that Mexico has suffered through. since the Mexican Revolution, and perhaps even that doesn't describe it. There's also election all about Washington, and Washington has been plenty involved in this thing. It's an election about where Mexico stands geopolitically. Is it the continual servile policies that both the pre and the pun have inflicted upon this country in obeisance to George Bush in Washington? Bush has already recognized Calderon. Or will Mexico resume its traditional position as being part of Latin America and align itself with the new left democracies in Latin America? And I think that's most of all what worries Washington and Bush at this moment.
John Ross, I wanted to ask you, when you look at the allegations of fraud here and the declarations of fraud by Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador, what's the most compelling evidence here that you see?
Well, there's a lot of compelling evidence. We began with a preliminary vote count in which the results were deliberately cooked to make it appear that Calderon won the election. 3 million votes were removed from the preliminary vote count by the Federal Electoral Institute. Its director, Luis Carlos Ugalde, he never bothered to tell anybody until he was quizzed on a morning television show and said, "Oh yeah, we put 3 million votes." It seemed to have certain inconsistencies and withdrew them from the prep. That was to give, of course, the rest of the world the idea that Calderon had won the election. The 16 states that the PRD and Lopez Obrador took, mostly in the South, have more votes for senators and congressional representatives than they do for president. And if we look at the PAN states, the 16 states in the North, there are more votes for president than there are for senators and congresspeople. This is inexplicable. And the only way to guarantee that there is electoral democracy here is to open up the ballot boxes and to count the votes.
If Lopez Obrador and his supporters do not get the recount that they are demanding, what are the consequences for Mexico?
Well, the consequences in Mexico are very, very serious. Calderon, if he is allowed to become president, will be a despised person, will not have any kind of control over the rest of the country. As I said, half the country is now aligned along class lines. If you could put the class war on the ballot, that's what we just had. No. So we're looking at years of resistance here. If indeed Calderon is imposed upon the people, that's going to have economic ramifications. It's going to radicalize this country. It's going to put an unstable state on your border. And it's not going to do much to alleviate the immigration problem.
That was journalist and author John Ross. His latest book is titled Murdered by Capitalism, published by Nation Books. Read Ross's articles online at www.counterpunch.org. After 4 years of controversy, tough new rules for welfare recipients were just enacted with President Bush's signing of the latest budget bill. The new regulations add more stringent work requirements to the welfare reform law passed in 1996, known as Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, or TANF. For 60 years before that, welfare was known as Aid to Families with Dependent Children, or AFDC. The program was set up in 1935 to help poor people, mostly women, take care of their children. Welfare rolls peaked in 1970 and continued their downward trend after the 1996 law was passed, as many poor women entered the workforce in a then-booming economy. But now, with a weak economy, some women are reaching the end of their 5-year lifetime limit for receiving welfare benefits. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mimi Abramovitz, a professor of social policy at the Hunter College School of Social Work in New York City. For 2 decades, she has studied how changes in the nation's welfare policies affect poor women and recently co-authored a book titled Taxes Are a Woman's Issue, Reframing the Debate, that relates tax policy to the issue of welfare reform. Abramovitz explains that in 1990, 85% of those eligible were receiving some kind of welfare assistance. Today, it's 48%.
She says some women benefited from welfare reform, but the large majority of women who are no longer receiving welfare benefits are still mired in poverty. And she explains some of the thinking behind punitive welfare reform legislation.
It was decided that women were lazy, taking advantage of the program, didn't want to work, needed the strong arm of the government to push them into the labor market. And so they made the changes called welfare reform, which were these mandatory work requirements, 5 years time limit, meaning no welfare after 5 years, no matter what happens to you. It's a lifetime limit. And a variety of other stringent requirements. The argument for that was misleading, number one. And the second part of the argument, which is getting more attention today, it didn't originally, is the idea that welfare breaks up families, that rising rates of single motherhood and teen pregnancies happened because women had access to welfare benefits. But again, the data show that that's not true. The marriage rates have been declining for all women for a very long time, let's say since 1950, and continue to decline after welfare reform. So welfare reform didn't change that. And teen pregnancy rates are also declining. I mean, we want teen pregnancy rates to decline, but they're declining, and they started declining before welfare reform. So this intervention, one could argue, it was not necessary to achieve those goals. Short of that, you could say you can't take credit for those marriage trends. In terms of work, most analysts, I think, across the political spectrum say that the large part of the reduction in welfare roles in terms of women going to work had to do with the fact that from 1996 to about 2000, the economy was booming. Industries that hired low-skilled workers were hiring at a faster rate. So, of course, more women left welfare, as they always did when jobs were available. Now that the economy is weaker, we find that in some states the where they can, women are coming back onto welfare.
I know a lot of advocates for poor women were saying that you can't just measure success by looking at how many women left the welfare rolls, but you also have to look at what happened to those women. So in a way, wouldn't a mandatory work requirement be helpful to them to see that women actually get jobs?
The mandatory requirements are that they work. There's no mandatory requirements that anyone hires them. And in fact, in addition to sort of forcing people into the labor market, whether there were jobs available or not, since most of the welfare recipients are women, one would think that, well, if you want to do that, you would at least provide child care. But at the same time, child care funding has been drastically reduced. Most recent budget cuts include some $11 billion, I think it's over 10 years, of underfunding for child care, according to the child care advocates.
Mimi Abramovitz, talk about your area of research and the book you just co-authored and how it relates to the question of welfare reform and the economic well-being of poor women.
Most of this research has looked at the spending side, like how government spends its money and how this money did or did not help poor women, especially as the money spent on welfare. The book that you mentioned, Taxes Are a Women's Issue, Reframing the Debate, looks at the revenue side. It looks at how the money was raised or not raised over time that supports not just welfare, but all public goods and services, from transportation, libraries, roads, including and all the social welfare programs. And what we found here is that since at least 1970, if not before, the tax system, which is mostly based on one's ability to pay, called the progressive income tax system, has really been increasingly not following that principle. And more those, the more wealthy or affluent taxpayers are paying disproportionately less than, and the, sort of the tax bill is being shifted to people, to low workers, especially low-income workers. And that's been happening through various changes in the number of the tax rate and the number of tax brackets, and it's been kind of invisible. But it started to become apparent to the wider public when, in 2000, when President Bush started the tax cut campaign. And when we analyzed these tax cuts, that was sort of the final step in kind of reducing the progressivity of the tax system. But it also fell very heavily on poor women, because when you cut taxes, you don't have any money to spend on things like child care, education, social welfare programs, and so on. And so the analysis shows that the program serving the poor, in which poor women are overrepresented, sort of lost most of the money. Most of the money that was cut came from those programs. It's a vulnerable population. It's a population that's largely of color. and it's single mothers. I call this a population that everybody loves to hate, unfortunately, and are not known for voting. So the book tries to argue for the need to find ways to raise revenue so we can support a better standard of living, not just for the poor, but for everybody.
That was Mimi Abramovitz, professor of social policy at Hunter College and co-author, along with Sandra Morgan, of the book Taxes Are a Woman's Issue, Reframing the Debate. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program.
We leave you with this quote by Roger Baldwin. Never yield your courage. Your courage to live, your courage to fight, to resist, to develop your own lives, to be free. I'm talking about resistance to wrong and fighting oppression. I am dead certain that human progress depends on those heretics, rebels, and dreamers who have been my kin in spirit and whose holy discontent has challenged established authority and created the expanding visions humankind may yet realize.